Jeff couldn't make it tonight. I'm his stand-in. My name's Tom. I'm a recovered alcoholic. By the grace of a loving God, I've been continuously sober since June the 15th of 1986, and for that date, I am truly, truly grateful. And I was taught early on that you don't be grateful, you do grateful if you are, and I hope that my Creator is aware of my efforts, and I believe my Creator is aware of my efforts, and I believe that I'm doing what I can to express my gratitude, not by doing this, but by the stuff that I do in AA. We're grateful to be here. Thank you all for having us. Popeye, thanks a lot. I called Popeye about 3 months ago, and I said, you know, my name's not Jeff, it's Tom. And you got it on the flyer that it's Jeff. He said, well, hell, it's an anonymous program. What difference does it make? I said, okay, all right. the 59th, boy, this is something incredible. You know, I was thinking tonight that I never knew anything about Ocean City, Maryland. I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up right outside New York City and knew the East Coast pretty well, but I knew the northern part, you know, Massachusetts and Cape Cod and the islands and like that, but never knew this area, never been down here. And the only time I'd ever heard of it was Rich B, in his talk, would talk about a surfer meditation in the morning with his sponsees or something, and something about duckies and stuff like that. And I've been looking for the duckies. I haven't found them yet, but hopefully they'll identify themselves. But anyway, so that's literally the only way I knew about this place. But what a beautiful place. We've been driving around and experiencing the food and the wild horses and, you know, a few other things. We plan on seeing a lot more, and we're really grateful to have been asked to be here. It's great to be here. So, let's see. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to me what that means, first and foremost, is I have a home group, and my home group meets in Santa Fe, New Mexico. On Monday nights at the Salvation Army, we're called An AA Group, is the name of my group. Comes from the long form of the third tradition, which states that any three or more gathered for the purpose of sobriety may call themselves an AA group. So we do. Yeah. We're a big book step group, and we read the big book very slowly and very carefully and very kindly. We don't beat anyone with it. We believe that love and tolerance of others is the code of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we try to manifest that at our group. We're a service-oriented group. We're a sponsorship-oriented group, and I love my home group. I'm very proud of it. And if you're ever in Santa Fe on a Monday night at 7 o'clock, please come to see us. We're an open meeting. We welcome Al-Anons with open arms. We welcome everyone with open arms, and we will make you feel welcome. That's one of the requirements, I believe. The other is that I have a sponsor. His name is Gary B. He lives in Indianapolis, and he says to give all of you his love. I just spoke to him tonight, and he's doing well. He's helped me tremendously, and I think without a sponsor, I would be rudderless. I don't know what I would do. I do know what I would do. I would go crazy. I sponsor people. That's, I believe, our job here. I think that's literally what we're supposed to be doing here. Some people disagree. I don't know why they would disagree. You know, read your big book, and I think it would convince you that that's the job that we have here. And I always say this, if you're not sponsoring, I would ask myself, other than to not be inconvenienced and because you're selfish, why would you not sponsor? You know what I mean? People say, I'm no good at it, you know, or I don't think I would be any good at it, that kind of thing. Well, you'll never know if you never try, you know, and it's not like we teach a course in it. You learn it in the trenches. So I'm encouraging you to get in and, you know, get your hands into it. It has been the thrill of my life, absolutely the thrill of my life. I sponsor, my wife says, way too many people. That's probably true. I love these guys like family. I'm as close to them as I am, in some cases closer than my own children. And I just love them like I can't even express to you. And I'll talk about that a little bit. So I'm doing that deal, and I always have a service position. I always try to. I think that's a really important deal. We've been moving back and forth between Santa Fe and Nashville, Tennessee, so it's been a little bit harder for me to commit to the things I used to commit to. I used to do a lot of prison work and like that. But I always have some kind of a service job, and I think that's important. You know, if you get in the middle of this thing, you'll stay in the middle. You know, you'll stay okay. And at least that's been my experience and what I've witnessed in the 30 years I've been around here. So quickly, I don't even know when I started, but quickly, I was a Southern kid who, born in the South in the 40s, was actually Bowling Green, Kentucky, which then was the Deep South. And I was born to Southern parents and was raised to be a Southern kid with Southern manners. You know, it was real different kind of a time then. I mean, we said yes ma'am and no sir, and if a lady walked in the room, you jumped up, and that's the way we were raised. And then at the tender age of 6, my parents decided they could have a better life in the North, and they moved to New York. They moved right outside New York City. And I did not take well to the move. I was, people in AA always say I felt like I didn't fit, I felt like a fish out of water, but I literally was one, and was reminded of it constantly when I first started school. And so it didn't start well. kind of jumping ahead, grew up, you know, there in the Northeast, but summers I would spend with my grandparents who were in Tennessee and Kentucky, so it was kind of a split deal, kind of a, you know, two different cultures, really, especially at that time in the 1950s. It was very different. And so came up kind of strangely that way. And in the late 60s, you know, there was a lot of social unrest in the country, you might have noticed. And it's kind of a, usually I'm speaking to people who have no idea what I'm talking about, but this is an older crowd, and I really appreciate it that you'll understand. Is there anyone in here who's ever heard of Ballantine Ale? Would you please raise your hand? Oh, my God. My drink of choice. You know? No one in Santa Fe has ever heard of that, you know, or anywhere else except on the East Coast. Anyway, so I'm with my people. So anyway, I got into the midst of all of that, and the civil rights movement was rocking and rolling. The war resister movement, the Vietnam War, was going, and I got into all the social activism stuff, and I won't bore you with all that, but it rocked along, and it started to get more and more radical, and at one point it was obvious it was going to get real violent. And I was in New York City with a group that just a kind of radical group, let's just say that, and realized that I needed to get away from that, or, you know, it was not going to be in my best interest, and that's putting it mildly. And so I'd met a gal, and we had hooked up, and we started running around the country together, and we ended up going out to visit her folks out in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and they arranged a wedding. Now, I was, not with a shotgun, but almost, and I was 21, she was 19, we got married, and she, it seemed like moments later, got herself pregnant. I'm not sure. But anyway, that happened, and we had escaped from New York, and we moved to a little island off of Cape Cod, 30 miles at sea. It's called Nantucket Island, and that's where I drank the Ballantine Ale, by the way. And so we were out there, and we were working class Nantucketers. We weren't like the, you know, the summertime tourist types or the, you know, wealthy Nantucketers. We were working class, and I had to get a job, which just absolutely destroyed me, the idea of that. I'd been a perpetual student for quite a while, and I got a job. The only jobs I looked in the paper that fall, and they were not hiring revolutionaries. They didn't have any. And but they were hiring masons and carpenters, and I became a carpenter's helper, and kind of became the grunt on a construction crew, low man. And just to set the tone, I'm 22 years old by now. I've got a wife that I'm kind of wondering, you know, if that marriage was really the right thing to have done. and I've got a child on the way, and I'm absolutely terrified, and I don't even know it. I know I'm always upset, I'm always on edge, but the truth was I was absolutely terrified. I knew I did not have what it took to be a father, I mean, or a husband, for that matter. And now I've got this job, and I'm working construction, and to backtrack a bit, I grew up with a lot of drinking. My parents entertained a lot. They were involved in the business world of New York City. There was a ton of drinking in the 50s and the 60s. Maybe some of you have seen that TV film or the series Mad Men, and that was literally how I grew up. That Mad Men was pretty true to course. Drinking was just a way of life. It lubricated the business world. It literally did. And my parents were probably alcoholic, you know. I mean, we don't like to pronounce anyone. We do it all the time, but we don't like to. But they, if they weren't, they've invented a new name for it. So I did not like drinking. I grew up with it. It affected me in a bad way. And we revolutionary types, we didn't drink, you know, because that deadened you to the social ills that needed your attention. On the other hand, we could smoke marijuana and take LSD because, you know, that opened your consciousness to new levels. And so it was kind of weird that way. But anyway, so I really didn't drink. I mean, I might have had a beer or something. And one night, the crew invites us up to the bar, invites myself up to the bar, and I hadn't been invited up that time. They just thought of me as the skinny punk kid who didn't know anything. And the other crew members were kind of big, burly guys who were from places like Boston and New York and Philly. And they were kind of badass guys, really. You know, they were kind of real criminals. But they were hiding out on Nantucket. And, you know, at that time, there was no internet. There was no way to find them. And so I was pretty intimidated by these guys. Like the little criminal activities I'd done had to do with being a revolutionary. But these guys had done some really horrible stuff, you know, and would talk about it, you know, when they were drinking. And so I was really intimidated, you know. I felt extremely insecure and inadequate, you know. I had a wonderful sponsor, Don P., who passed away 11 years ago, and I told him that one time. I said, "Don, you know, I just felt so insecure and so inadequate." And he said, "Do you know why?" And I wondered, you know, I thought, he's going to lay it on me. He said, "That's because you were insecure and you were inadequate." No, not that. So, you know, it has to be something from my past that's a deep-seated psychological deal. Anyway, we go to the bar. It was quite the honor to be invited by these guys, and I go to the bar with them, and I'm sipping some of that Ballantine ale, three-ring sign, and a fellow says, "Here, I bought you a drink," and he sticks a shot glass in front of me. It's got amber fluid in it. No idea what it was, but he bought me a drink. I was not going to refuse it, so I'm watching these guys toss it back, so I toss one back, and it was bourbon. Turned out to be Jack Daniels, and it kind of burned on the way down, but it tasted familiar to me, okay? And I realized later that it tasted like what all my southern relatives kind of smelled like, you know what I mean? My grandmother used to make these bourbon balls. They were chocolate with a bourbon center, and she'd send them to me at school, and it tasted like that. And probably I smelled that when I was laying in the crib, and they were hanging over me, you know? So it's like racial memory. It went way back. And I had never enjoyed the taste of alcohol ever, but that tasted kind of good. About 10 minutes later, another shot arrives. One of these guys bought me one, and I knock it back, and it seemed like the world changed. You've heard this. You know, it just seemed like everything changed. I fit in my skin. You know, I was not intimidated by these guys. I was one of the men. You know, a punk kid had grown up and become a man, and I was with my peers now, you know. It was this grubby little place called the Chicken Box. It was where we were, and they hadn't served chicken there in 30 years. And I made amends on Nantucket. I took Juanita back there and took her into the Chicken Box. They hadn't started, you know, serving it then. And she goes, "You've been talking about this place for years. I couldn't be more underwhelmed." And she said, "It's just..." Well, it meant a lot to me, honey. That's all I can tell you. It was a bucket of blood joint, you know. Anyway, it just lit something in me. It lit me up. And I just, it wasn't, you know, the slow progression that some people have. It was like, boom, Alice, right to the moon, you know. And it just took off, literally. And it was a short time before I was drinking every day. And I had consequences, got into some real bad scuffles. Scuffle's a nice way to put it. This sailor kicked me half to death in the street there in Nantucket for me saying something about his mother that I never should have said. And they nearly hospitalized me. And as I was laying there recuperating, I thought, I'll never say that to a sailor again. But I never put together, you know, that I should stop drinking. Anyway, the drinking progressed, you know, as it does. And I'm going to jump forward a bit on this. But that gal and I had another, we had that child and we had another child. And then we lived the alcoholic life for quite a few years where there's never enough money. The landlord's at the door. We, you know, back in the day, we used to put $2 of gas into a car, and that would take you some ways, you know, at one point. I see some heads nodding, thank you. But then we'd always run out of gas, you know, and we'd just jump out and start hitchhiking. I mean, it was a horrible way of life. You know, it was really terrible, especially for them. You know, a lot of times we tell our stories, and we tell about how terrible it was for us, you know. But can you imagine how terrible it was for the families that were sober, having to live with that crap and witness that and feel every bit of that? I was numb, you know. My family was not numb, you know. My kids were traumatized by that way of life. So anyway, fast forward, that wife, she finally just couldn't stand it any longer. I mean, she just, you know, it was untenable. She couldn't live like that and with my kids. And so she left, and that just destroyed me. We had moved to Santa Fe by then. And so more drinking and more, you know, craziness, and I added drugs to the mix because I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. I was so distraught that I'd lost my family. And met a little gal, and we teamed up and started housekeeping together. And she lasted about 2 years and then realized that this was definitely not in her best interest to hang around with me. And she took off. And right about that time, I met the love of my life, Juanita, who is sitting back there someplace. She is my current and forever wife. Please stand up. And it's just been marital bliss ever since. 38 years of marital bliss. No, except when she tried to drown me when I passed out in the bathtub. That was not blissful. That wasn't good. If you have a pre-Al-Anon, don't drink in the tub like I used to. But if you don't, drink in the tub. It's warm, you know. I used to sit there. I'd get my whole setup, my book and my bourbon, and kind of do it. And then eventually I would pass out, and I'd kind of slide into the tub, but you know, and then when the water got cold enough, I'd get out. Any bathtub drinkers in the crowd? Not so many. You drank more ale than you drank in the bathtub, but I'm always wondering about that. I thought I was unique till I got to AA. So anyway, we met, and we it was lust at first sight. We met at a wedding, and we kind of took off together. We would hook up every once in a while, and then finally we had a real date. We were going to go see Taj Mahal play. Still haven't seen him, but anyway. But on a Friday night, I'd been working on this construction job where you could drink tequila as you worked, and so we did that all day. And then for a little more go power, we were kind of, the guy was giving us cocaine every once in a while, but drinking tequila all day. And then we got paid that Friday, and we went to the bar to do some actual drinking. You know, I mean, that was just kind of recreational stuff. And so I switched to bourbon, and I think that was a bad mistake. And what happened was a plumber friend challenged me to arm wrestle him, and I went for it. And he snapped my right arm in half. That's the short side of that story. And so they rushed me off to the hospital, and they were going to operate on me that night. Those spiral fractures like that are really bad. They have to, it's a long operation to get it back together. And here I'm a right-handed carpenter, and he broke my right arm. And so they were going to do it, but they fortunately they took my a blood test to see what shape I was in, and they said that my blood alcohol was so high that they thought the anesthesia would have killed me. So they couldn't do the operation until the next day. They put it off till 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day till my blood alcohol was lower. And I went into the operation, and when I came out of recovery, there was Juanita. She had come and was helping them push the gurney back from the back into my room. You know, my angel had showed up, you know. And it just got better from then on. I've said to her, no, didn't you think that when our first date ended up in the OR, that like maybe that was an indicator that, you know, of things to come? But at any rate, a lot of bad stuff did happen. And she had a daughter, I had two sons, and we got together and she got pregnant and we had a child of our own. So now we had yours, mine, and ours. And they really were. And during the worst times, we used to use our children against each other, which I am deeply ashamed of. But at any rate, things got really rough with us. And eventually, I started to try to control and enjoy the drinking. And that was obvious that wasn't going to happen. So I tried to stop entirely. And what happened to me has happened to some people. I think a bunch of us have gotten to this point, but I started fighting booze. I mean, I tried every which way to not drink. And I went to a psychologist for a while, but lied to the psychologist. I tried some spiritual stuff. I was a total vegetarian for 6 years. No meat, fish, or eggs. Fortunately for me, Jack Daniels, heroin, and Camel Straight cigarettes were all vegetables, or I'd have been in big trouble, and that's the truth. Anyway, but that did not work. And any Antabusians in the crowd? I know we got some Antabusians, yeah, right. I don't think they give that anymore. They don't, not much. And because it has a tendency to kill people when they drink. They gave me Antabuse, and I took it, and I drank, and I got ill, and I got sick, really sick, and that worked perfectly. To this day, I've not found it necessary to take Antabuse again, so it's perfect. At any rate, The thing that should have worked was the love of my children and the love of my wife. You know, my wife would say things like, "You got to leave. You got to get out of here. I can't stand to watch you killing yourself any longer. It's tearing me apart. I can't do it." And my children, my little boys, would beg me not to drink. Beg me. I'd have we used to call them shooters. They call them nips, I think, on the East Coast. We call them shooters. And I'd have one, and I'd be about to drink it, and my little son would be begging me, "Give me a pep talk. Daddy, you don't have to drink that. Please don't drink that. You know you don't have to drink that. Please don't." And I'm drinking it in front of him, watching his heart break. And he doesn't know, but my heart's breaking too at the same time. And nothing seemed to work. Absolutely nothing seemed. Then a guy said to me, "Well, you know, there is something that will quell that need to drink." And I call it the heroin maintenance program for alcoholism, you know. And if you try just a little recreational heroin, you know, you can substitute. And, you know, I'm willing to do anything for the cause, so I try. And it backfired terribly, because what happened was I got strung out on heroin and I never stopped drinking, ever, because I'm a real alcoholic, you know. And just a mess, just a horrible mess. And, you know, I'll tell you how I got to recovery. What I was saying about some of us get to a point, I knew I could not stop drinking. I knew that I couldn't live on this planet without chemical assistance, you know? I absolutely hated myself. I loathed myself, but I knew that there was no way that I could function, you know, on this planet being who I am, you know, without some assistance of some sort, booze, drugs, or preferably both. There, my theme song back then was a song that was written by Randy Newman, and the version I liked the best was Joe Cocker's version. A lot of people did it, but it was called Guilty. And he said, "I'm guilty, yes, I'm guilty, and I'll be guilty for the rest of my life. How come I never do what I'm supposed to do? How come nothing that I ever do ever seems to turn out right?" And I thought, God, that guy's reading my mail. And he goes on and he says, "You know how it is with me, baby. You know, I just can't stand myself. And it takes a whole lot of medicine for me to pretend like I'm somebody else." And that was me. That was my deal. And I just assumed that some night, you know, I drove in blackouts constantly. Blackouts were an everyday occurrence with me. And I thought some night, that 20-mile drive from Santa Fe to where we live, I'll just, you know, mercifully I'll hit a bridge or something and be put out of my misery. And then thank God, because everybody who cares about me in any way, shape, or form will be better off, you know. And I literally thought that. And what happened was it just wouldn't happen. It just wouldn't happen. I mean, I would run into things, you know, asleep at the wheel, all sorts of things would happen, but I never did die, and I never did stop. And finally, I had worked myself into a situation where I had to get out of Santa Fe, or I was the sheriff was going to get me. So I knew that I needed to get into a detox to hide out. I'd heard of people doing this. You know, they go to rehab to hide out, right? I mean, you guys have probably spoken in rehabs. I've been doing it for 30 years, and half the people there are just hiding out. They're not there to get well. They're there to hide out. So I went down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and to a rehab down there, and went in not to get sober, because I knew it was impossible, but just to get away from the storm that I had created of my life in Santa Fe. Bad checks, stealing from a business partner who was a violent drunk. He'd been a Marine in Vietnam, and when he found out that I'd been dipping in, man, he was not going to be happy. And I had a wife that hated me. I had children that were terrified of me, absolutely scared of me. And I didn't have a friend in the world. My one friend was this guy I'd been stealing from. So we had some insurance because my wife had an actual job where she worked for the state of New Mexico, and so I could get into this rehab. And I went down there to hide out. And one of the things, is Angie in here? I don't know if she made it tonight. You should hear her talk. She gave an incredible talk last night. Was that not amazing? Really great. I've heard Angie three times. That was definitely the best I ever heard her. And nobody sings Amazing Grace like Angie. But at any rate, I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had the same experience that Angie had. You know, I'm married to what I call a Chicana. You know, now it's the proper word is Hispanic or whatever. But, you know, they don't call themselves Hispanics where I live. They call themselves Chicanos. You know, I'm proud of it. And the guys that I ran around with were Chicanos, you know. And I go into this AA meeting, and it's like nothing but white faces, you know. I had an architect buddy who had gotten sober, and he offered to take me to a meeting. I went there to get her off my back is really why I went. And I went to two meetings. All I remember is some old white guy had been to Europe, and he's old. He was probably 42, you know. He's talking about, how wonderful his trip to Europe was, and that was his old pitch. And I thought, you know, I'm a white guy. I've been to Europe. It didn't do a damn thing for me, you know. I could give a crap about your trip to Europe. You know, what is this thing, you know? And plus, there were no Chicanos. There were no Indians, you know, the people of color that I hang out with. And I thought, this is some white crap, you know. Now, I'm white, but I'm judging everybody for being white, you know. That's why I wanted Angie to hear this. At any rate, so I went back. I told Juanita, I've got it. You know, I told her I went to the classes, and I won't drink anymore, you know. And I didn't for 67 days until I did, you know, because I'm a real alcoholic, and went on that last tear. So I go down to this place, the care unit in Albuquerque. I didn't want to go into one in Santa Fe because it might hurt my business, you understand, if someone were to see me going into this rehab. That's a joke, okay? I had run that business into bankruptcy, but at any rate. So I'm down there, and I had this one particular night. They were giving me just enough meds that I wouldn't have a seizure. I was physically addicted to alcohol and physically addicted to heroin at the same time. And so they had to medicate me, and they did, but just so much. And I couldn't sleep at night. And this one night that, I'll never forget this, you know, if you've ever heard Sister B speak, I heard her speak in Taos one time, and she said, you know, I'd like to come down there, and I'd like to ask each and every one of you, when did you die? When did you die? And I could have jumped out of my seat and screamed, B, I know exactly when it was, you know, exactly. And it was this one night in particular. I was in there about four days. And this one night I couldn't sleep, and I laid awake, and clearly I saw my life for what it had become, you know, clearly. You know, I called myself a father, but all I did was lie to my children, you know. I would tell my boys I'd pick them up for the weekend. And I'd say, I'll be there at 5:30, 6 o'clock to get you guys, so be ready, you know, because I don't want to have to talk to your mom. And I'd get there at 10 o'clock, and she'd say, you're drunk, get out of here. I put him to bed hours ago, you know. Lying to the kids, to the people that you mean the very most of any man in their lives, and breaking that trust, that I don't know if that can ever be regained, you know. I thought of my wife, you know. All I ever did was lie to her. I would lie first and then try to discern whether I could have told the truth or not. But I was always on the defense with her. My business partner, my only friend who I'd been stealing from. And I started to think about the money that I owed. Like all over the United States, I'd left debts in Nantucket. I'd borrowed money from banks and run away. I'd borrowed money from good friends and then just left it hanging. But I hadn't forgotten that. You know, when I got sober, I talked to a sponsor guy, and I said, his name was Ray, and I said, Ray, you know, a lot of the crimes that I committed, there's statute of limitations on those. And he said, yeah, that's true. He said, the problem is that the subconscious knows no statute of limitations. It really doesn't. And it took me years to really, really understand what he was saying, you know. That the stuff that I have done that goes against my morals and my values and my principles, if I try to live a happy, joyous, and free, sober life and don't clean that stuff up, I'm going to be dragging it with me whether I know it or not. It's coming along, baby. And then I wonder why I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, sober, you know. Going to meeting after meeting after meeting. Anyway, so I'm laying there and I'm thinking about all this stuff, and then I started thinking about the women that I'd mistreated, the girlfriends I'd had, you know, the adultery with my first wife, you know, all of that stuff. It just came back to me, and I just broke. Something in me broke that night. I just started crying, started weeping, you know, deeply, and just to see what had happened to me. And I believe that is a surrender that, you know, it didn't feel good. I mean, absolutely felt horrible, but it was one of the best nights of my life. It changed something internally in me. And, you know, and I've never been the same. I really have never been the same. Anyway, I'm in that place, and I'm sitting in the cafeteria one morning because I can't sleep. And I look out through some plate glass windows out onto a patio. This is June in Albuquerque, you know, summertime. And there's a bunch of people, and it's early in the morning, and they're setting something up out there. And I say to this guy I'm sitting next to, I said, what's going on out there? Like, some people are going out there. And he said, oh, that's some extra AA deal. It's not a part of the program. You don't have to do that. You know, it's like, you don't get any credit for it. It's not like extra credit. It's just some... He said, really, you know what? The ass kissers go out there. That's who goes to that. Don't even think about it, you know. He said, and then as an afterthought, he said, yeah, but, you know, they do have real coffee with caffeine in it out there. Right? And really? You know, because we're drinking decaf in the unit, and it's not giving me the buzz that I want. And so I go out to AA for the coffee, literally. And the only place I've ever heard of people going to AA for coffee is prison or jail. That's really, you know, it's like, your coffee may be great at your home group. Mine is pretty good, but I don't think it would draw me into AA. So I go out and I drink their coffee, and as much as I can, 3 or 4 cups, and then you could smoke cigarettes. And so I smoke about 5 Camels, you know, in the course of a meeting. And it seemed that they had changed AA since I'd been there. These guys, the kind of the honchos of this thing, were these 2 Chicano guys. And they're telling these gnarly stories that were like, whoa, man, you know, it got my attention. And they're telling stuff, and then they're laughing at themselves. Ha, 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 you know, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. And I'm thinking, this is really weird. This is really different than those Santa Fe meetings. And so I plugged in. You know, I plugged in. I thought, there's something about this, you know. And you could go every morning. The name of the group was Dawn Patrol, and they're a pretty big meeting now in Albuquerque, but at that time they had like 7 members. They were a year old, and they brought the meeting into the treatment center and held it there every day, every day. And there's still people like me who 30 years later go back there and get a token, you know, and thank them for having been there. So this one big guy, his name was Ruben. He heard my first fifth step, just a horrible little fifth step, but important to me, maybe the best I've ever done. And he heard that in the unit. And I trusted him because I'd been out there with him and I'd heard his story. He used to get drunk and go to Old Town in Albuquerque and roll drunks. And the way he knew it was that he'd find wallets in the trunk of his car. So he knew what he had done. And he told the story, and he said, you know, he was a big guy, big Chicano guy, and he talked like this. And he goes, you know, I was an orderly at the VA hospital, and I was very depressed. And so I stole 100 Libriums, and I washed them down with a pint of vodka, and I jumped from the 4-story window to the ground below, and all that happened was I crapped in my pants. And I went, hallelujah. I joined AA that day, put $1 in the basket. If Ruben's here, I'm in. That's it. So Ruben's still alive. I was just with him. I just kissed him on the cheek about 2 weeks ago. And he's on oxygen and, you know, he's got some health issues, but he's still hanging in there. And James, the other guy who set everything up, you know, I talked to him. He was a pretty tough guy, you know, and tough Chicano from Albuquerque. And, you know, I'd talk to him about different stuff. And I said, on the 3rd of July, I'll never forget, I said, so James, you know, tomorrow's 4th of July. You guys aren't coming in tomorrow, right? And he looks at me just with disdain, and he goes, well, my disease doesn't go on vacation. I don't know about yours. You know, I thought, whoa, that's tough, you know. But check it out. He was there the next day setting up the coffee at 6:30 a.m. on the 4th of July. And what I got was these guys do what they say they're going to do. You know what I mean? Man, you know, we can stand up here and flap our lips and do all sorts of stuff, but doesn't that speak a lot more, of a lot more depth than anything we'll ever say, you know? That we do what we say we're going to do. That if I tell you I'm going to do it, I deliver, you know? To me, that spoke volumes because nobody in my world did that, you know? And James would say these things like he said, you know, I used to hate myself. I absolutely hate it. I loathe myself. And I thought, I got that one down. And he said, you know, today I look in the mirror and I like the guy that's looking back at me. And he goes, some days I love that guy. And I thought, man, if I could ever have even a little piece of that, you know, what a gift that would be. What an incredible reward, you know. So anyway, they lit a fire under me. And I got to get this going because there's some stuff I want to tell you. They lit a fire under me for AA, and all I knew was that I'd been going to meetings every day while I was there. So when I got back to Santa Fe 33 days later, I neglected to tell you one thing. I asked both Reuben and James, how the hell do guys like you stay sober? I mean, you guys should be in the penitentiary. And here you are sober, like doing this stuff that you're doing. How do you do that? They both answered the same thing, and I asked them independently. They both said, we pray to God in the morning, and we ask God to keep us sober. And if we're sober at night, we say, thank you, God, for my sobriety. And they both said the same thing. Now, I've been around the world, okay? I'd been in the school that traveled around the world, and I'd seen some really ugly stuff in the world. And, you know, I knew full well, I mean, I'm a pragmatist. There could not be a God, not with the stuff I've seen. I mean, that's just crazy. I gave that up, you know, 1,000 years ago. You know, it's just, that's absurd. You know, that's just something that people use to control other people. You know, that's all that is. But here's the trick. I was out of game, you know. I had nothing to lose at all. Reuben and James said they prayed, so I started praying to nothing, to Reuben and James's God. And when I got out of that place, I was 33 days sober, and my personal best, excuse me, in 16 years had been 8 days on the Natch. That was the best I ever put together. And now I've got 33 days, and the only difference that I know of is I thank God every night that I'm sober, and I do it every night, and I never miss. And I added the most precious gift I've ever been given. That's what I would say. And so I go back to Santa Fe, and I'm a Meeting Makers Make It guy, and I'm making a lot of meetings, and I'm doing all this. And I'm kind of working some steps, but it's kind of a as Tom sees it kind of a deal, you know. What suited me, you know, take what you like and leave the rest. You know, I did not like a lot of the steps, and so I left them and just got busy. I prayed. I tried to help other alcoholics. I'd give them rides. I'd, you know, do things like that. I became a counselor in a treatment center for 2 years, nearly got drunk. By the grace of God, did not. Made it out of there. And at 5.5 years, I was taking a guy on my construction crew down to Roswell, New Mexico to a conference, an AA conference. And he and I went down there, and I heard a set of tapes by a guy, and he said on the set of tapes, it was a one-day step workshop out in California. And he said, you know, if you will submit to the process that's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's guaranteed, if you do what it says, if you absolutely do it to the best of your ability, that you will recover from alcoholism. Not that you'll be cured, not that that's the end game of the deal, but you will recover. You won't want to drink, and you won't have to drink, you know? And I thought, my God, I've never heard that message. I mean, that's really an incredible message. So this guy was going to be speaking out in Amarillo, Texas. I went out there the next fall, and I met him. And he showed me how to write inventory, as outlined in the Big Book, on a cocktail napkin, you know? And he asked me questions that I had never been asked before, like, how do you write inventory? And I said, what, Hazelden or CompCare? What do you mean? He goes, no, man, like, you know, 4 columns for resentment and, the fears and then the 9 questions of the sex conduct inventory. I'd never heard of that. I'd been 6 years sober almost. I'd never, ever been exposed to that. And so I jumped on it. And he suggested that I go to this conference up in Colorado that was just starting that year. It was 93. Called Fellowship of the Spirit. It was in Breckenridge, Colorado, and this man, Don Pritz, had started it. And he said, I said, why would I want to go to that? He said, well, it's like the Cannes Film Festival of people who do the work from the Big Book. And I thought, cool, you know, I want to do that. Bob is here, and Rich, they both have spoken at that conference, and that's been our home conference for 24 years that it's been going. We've never missed. And what happened was when I went up there, I met people who were doing this deal. The late, great Clint Hodges. Man, if you never heard his talks, listen to them. I just adored the guy. And he liked me, which was nice, too. You know, not everybody does. I mean, I'm sure that surprises you. But Clint Hodges was up there, and Earl Husband from Oklahoma, the late, great Earl Husband, was doing the fourth step. And Don had picked all these people. And it was just miraculous. You know, I was scared to go up there. I thought these Big Book thumpers, they're mean, you know, SOB, beat you with the book. And it wasn't like that at all. There was more laughter and more tears than I'd ever, ever experienced in AA. And it just lit me on fire for doing this deal. And I've been doing it ever since. Don became my sponsor sometime after that. And, well, he was the finest man I ever knew. He was my mentor. He was my friend. He was like a father to me. And I'm still grieving his loss 11 years later. I just absolutely adored him, and he helped me in ways that are, I just can't even put into words, you know. But he was a loving man. He was a very loving man. And he influenced a lot of people. There's people all over America who still come up to me and they say, tell me about Don. What was he like, you know? Anyway, so it was a heck of a ride. And, you know, I went back to where I live in Santa Fe and started yakking about the big book and the steps, and nobody wanted to hear it. It was not at all a popular message. I was the Lone Ranger for quite a while, you know. And then little by slow, what happened was you pick up desperate people, people who are really desperate, you know. What I've seen in AA over the years is that, you know, to some people, alcohol was kind of an inconvenient habit that they had that needed breaking, you know, and they really shouldn't do it. They really should stop drinking, you know. To me, it was a way of life. To me, it was a way to survive, you know. I married it, and it was till death do us part. I mean, it really was. And so my relationship with booze was different than some people in AA. And so what I tend to run into is those people, those desperate types, who really want more, and they want to go deeper. And, you know, what they've realized is that for them, and I know this isn't true for everyone, that, you know, going to AA meetings will not keep them sober, and it certainly won't give them a happy life. They've got to do something to address that spiritual malady deep inside them, you know. And not everyone has to. I mean, I get that. But these people do, and they're the ones that gravitate to me. And we've had a heck of a ride with this. I'm not kidding you. You know, I've talked to people who say, you do the big book, you read the big book, you work steps from the big book, and that's great. And then you've done that, and then what? You know. And for me, it hadn't been like that. You know, I have found worlds upon worlds within that book. We go deeper and deeper and deeper. And a really cool thing is that younger people, I'm talking about people under 5 years, are starting to get stuff that it took me 25 years to get. And I absolutely love it. It's what we're trying to do. We're raising a crop. You know, we are. And I know a lot of you all are doing that, you know. So we've been looking lately at principles being, you know, belief systems, you know. Belief systems that predicate how I live my life, you know. Bill Wilson talked about some of us who tried to hold on to our old ideas. What are my old ideas? You know, what are my really deep old ideas that make me behave the way I behave and I'm not even aware of it? Let's dig in. Let's get into that. Let's put that through the inventory process. There are worlds upon worlds in that book. I mean, it just, you know, I can't even say. So what has happened? I've got a few minutes to wrap this up, I guess. My children were traumatized, to say the very least. You know, they were scared of me. They acted out for a lot of years. They have all gotten to the place where they can let me have it, you know, with both barrels, you know, and all four of them, you know. And I believe what the deal is, that they trust that if they get mad at me and they scream at me and they tell me how it was, you know, in their childhood, that it won't get me drunk, you know, and that I won't stop loving them. You know what I'm saying? They trust that. They trust that. And so there's been healing that's happened, you know. It's not some fairy tale butterfly deal, but man, it's a heck of a lot better than it would have been. You know, it really is. I'm proud of all four of my children. They're really incredible. If I had more time, I'd tell you all about them and what they've been doing. But every one of them is a good person, and every one of them tries to help other people, which is the most important thing we do in life, I think. They're good folks. I have 8 grandchildren. If I hadn't gotten sober in AA, I'd have never known one of them, not one. And if I had possibly lived on, which a doctor had told me was impossible, my children would not have wanted me to be around their children at all. My grandchildren love me. They absolutely adore me. Juanita and I have a tremendous relationship, you know. In a blackout one night, I came to in a squad car with two cops calling me a wife beater. And I said, you're out of your mind. I have never laid a hand on a woman in my life. I would never do that to the woman that I love. And they said, is that why there's blood all over your hands? And I ended up being hauled off to the drunk tank, and the next morning was brought before the judge, who was a good friend of my mother-in-law, who was a court clerk. And P.S. had been the judge that married us, right? And they read this horrible, horrible thing that I have no recollection of whatsoever, not at all. I don't know if she'll tell this in her story on Friday, but she almost drowned me in the bathtub when I was passed out there. That's not a loving relationship, guys, you know? And today we love and admire each other, we're proud of each other, and we're on this path together, you know? We do this deal together. I was just thinking about this earlier. My daughter, who lives in Nashville, her name is Nieves, which means snows in Spanish, and she's just a terrific gal. And when she was seven when I got sober, and Juanita asked her when she was about eight or nine, said, do you remember your dad when he was drinking? And she goes, well, not much, a little bit. And she said, what do you remember? And Nieva said, well, he was always mad at everybody, and he fell down a lot, okay? I mean, I could walk in the front door and fall down. You know, Don used to say this, worst thing I did to my family was I was a surprise. They didn't know who was showing up. The nice dad, the sweet dad who telling me loved him, you know, or the mean, vicious dad, you know. Or the dad who would stand there and urinate in the living room floor in front of their little friends who they no longer could bring home. You know what I mean? They never knew. So things have changed an awful lot in that regard. And I have a host of friends. I've told you that these sponsees of mine are, you know, I'm as close to their family. I mean, it's not close as family. They are family. They absolutely are. You know, when all the internet stuff came out, when I went through college, there were no computers, and I know a lot of you all, same deal, right? And so I didn't take to it. My handle is Cyber Moron, okay? I'm learning, though, guys. I'm doing a better job. And so I was kind of, when Facebook came out and all of this, I was kind of, you know, poo-pooed it, you know, in terms of AA connection and stuff. And actually, I've changed my mind a lot on that, a whole lot, because we've gone through internet connections and hooked people up around the world. I mean, absolutely around the world, and maybe saved lives, for all I know. So for all the anonymity breaks and the things I don't like about all that, there have been some really good things. And, you know, I never was one to Skype. I don't like the way I look on Skype. You know, I'm still vain. But, you know, I started because a guy, when we were in Australia, a guy asked me to sponsor him. And I said, how will we do that? He said, we'll do it by Skype. And I said, I'll try it. And so Damien and I, every Saturday, it's Sunday morning at 6 a.m. for him, but it's 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoon for me, we sit and we Skype and we do this. And I've literally taken him through the steps. He's almost done with all of his ninth step amends, almost all of them. And he's a tenth stepper like you wouldn't believe. You know, I listened to his fifth step on Skype. I mean, I never thought that would be possible. And both of us crying. I mean, both of us crying. It was just amazing, you know. And he wrote me, texted me something. We couldn't get together this last weekend, but he called and then we texted. And he said, you know, it's Father's Day here in Australia. And he said, my dad's dead, has been for many years. He was a drunk, as you know. And he said, but I thank God for you because you've taken the place of my father, you know? Whew, man. I'd do anything for that kid, you know? Kid, he's 40-some and has two children, you know? And I'd do anything for him, you know? Juanita and I have been, we've been allowed to represent Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon a lot of different places. You know, we've gone to Iceland years ago and have dear friends there who come and visit us. I've spoken in Mexico. I spoke at an AA meeting in Cuba in Spanish, sweating like a dog. You know, we've been to Australia. We did workshops all over Australia for a month. Juanita sponsors a gal there who arranged it, and it was just a fantastic trip. We fell in love with those people. 2.5 years ago, a guy asked me to go to Russia with him and do the traditions in Moscow. And I said, I'm not the best traditions guy. You know, I know a couple of guys, and I named them. And he said, well, they didn't ask them. They asked you. And in January. And I said, well, hold on. Let me call my sponsors. So I called Gary. He said, you're going to Russia, you know. And I thought, well, that's great. Russia was not on my bucket list at all. I'm telling you, it was the last place on earth I wanted to go. So I called JR, the guy that asked me, and I said, okay, you know, yes, I'll go. And he said, well, the Russians got in touch with me. They think May might be a better time. I said, thank you, God, you know. And so we went. And, of course, I fell in love with all the Russians, you know. They were fabulous. They were so kind to me. They were so good to me, you know. These Russians, who I thought would be like cold fish Northern Europeans, they were like the Hispanics back where we live. When they would hug you, man, it's a bear hug. I mean, they hold on to you, you know. And they were really sad to see us go. And I picked up a sponsee in Siberia, of all places, you know. We can't even speak to each other, but we do it by translator. And he's finished his amends, which is great. Anyway, I'll end with this. A couple of things I wanted to tell you. You know, making amends and finishing your amends was not popular in the AA in my town. You would not hear anything talked about that hardly at all. And if you did, it would usually be someone justifying why they didn't have to make an amends because it would hurt them. You know, it says, except them or others. Well, I'm others, and so if it'll hurt me, I don't have to do it. And that's what you would hear. And I like that. That sounded good, you know. But that's not what these big book people were saying. They were talking about going the distance and finishing all your amends that you're consciously aware of or that you see on an inventory. And I know a bunch of you guys have done a lot of this. And I wanted what they had. I wanted freedom. You know, this guy, Mark H., he used to say, how free do you want to get? Do you want a half measure? You want a half measure of this? And I thought, no, I was a mad dog drinker. I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to be a half measure, you know, recovery guy. And I got busy with it, and it took a long time. And I owed a lot of money. And I owed a lot of explanations to old girlfriends and to, you know, to different people, you know, that I had harmed. And what I did, and this, we got this from our buddy Tom Ivester years ago. He said, by making my amends, I was buying pieces of my soul back one piece at a time. And there's nowhere else, there's no other way that you can buy that. You just can't do it. It's not for sale any other way. And I wish there'd been more time. I would tell you all about but the trail that I had to go on to do that. But when I paid back all the money, money started coming to me. And I'm a very rich man, not with money, because I don't seem to be able to keep any of it, but with human, heartfelt friendships and love, I am extremely rich. When I went, you're not supposed to go see old girlfriends or old lovers or whatever, I did. I went to, one was in Connecticut, one was in California. I went to see both of them. They both just were thrilled that I would come back and talk about, you know, how, you know, I had treated them in a really disrespectful and horrible way, you know, and tell them that they didn't deserve to be treated that way. I think it made them feel better about themselves. But I know it made my relationship with Juanita better. It absolutely did. So that was that piece, and you know what? As a result of that, I can help these guys that I sponsor make their amends. You know, they'll say, "There's no way I can make this particular amends." You know, and I say, "Yeah, you can. I did it. Look in my eyes." You know, I was sending a guy to Rich from New Orleans, I think, 2-3 years ago. I don't know if you ever made it up here, but, you know, we know people, we can help each other out and help each other get free. I'll end with this. I was, when we went to Russia, JR and I joked that they worked us like Russian immigrants. They worked us like rented mules is what they did. And we didn't know what we were doing. I mean, it was on a need-to-know basis only, you know. They would tell us, you know, okay, now you're getting on this train. And we had no idea. I mean, they just let us know that. So we're in Moscow for about 5 days, and they say, okay, you're flying to Siberia now, 4,800 miles. So we take this flight to Siberia. We land in one town where we have to talk to a bunch of people. The next morning, a guy picks us up at 6 a.m. to drive us 8 hours to this other town, where we're then going to catch a train to go overnight, a 12-hour trip to this other town, where we're finally going to end up and do a step workshop. So this guy's driving us along Lake Baikal, which is apparently like the longest lake in the world. It's a third of the world's fresh water is in this lake. And it's May, but it's snowy there. And the roads are horrible. They're pitted. They're, you know, potholes. There's snow and ice everywhere. And this guy is driving like a bandit, man. I mean, this guy is going absolutely nuts. JR's in the back with these two Russian gals. And this guy is passing these big Chinese logging trucks, and he's swerving and sliding and stuff. And one of the girls in the back is going, ha, 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 we call him Cowboy. He's Cowboy. That's what we all call him. And I'm thinking, well, Cowboy's going to kill my ass, you know. And so, you know, I thought, literally, I could die right here. Like, I could literally die right here, you know. I mean, he could slide off and hit one of these trees in a heartbeat. I mean, you know, he could pass a logging truck and have a car hit us, you know. And suddenly I realized that would be okay. That would really be okay. Like, I could die right now, and I'd be fine. I'd be at peace. You know what I mean? I'm trying to do work for AA. I don't have any unfinished business that I'm aware of. And I'm at peace, and I could die comfortably right now and get ready for the next adventure, whatever it is. You guys gave me that. AA gave me that, and God gave me that, and I am so grateful for it. Thanks for listening to me. God bless you.